Okay, testing. Can you hear me? Can anybody hear me? Oh, good. I'm kind of wondering that too. Maybe I'll go on to the next page. You've probably read my title several times now. I'm Neil Brown, as it's set up there, from University of New South Wales. And I want to talk to you about a new file system that I'm working on. A new sort of general purpose file system, but as I said in my abstract, in a sense, there isn't such a thing as a general purpose file system. Each file system tends to have some sort of focus. So I'm going to start off talking about file system priorities. You know, when you put together a file system, when you choose a file system, what sorts of things can you look for? And there are different things that are important to different people, and that causes people to make different choices. That's why we have quite a few different file systems in Linux kernel at the moment, and that's why I hopefully will have another one in, I don't know, a year or two, whenever it gets done. Obviously, there are others being worked on too, as you've probably heard of Riserifus, and Hans Reiser is busily working on Riser 4, the next one in that series. So maybe it's a growth area. So I'll talk about different priorities. I'll talk about my personal priorities, what I want to see in a file system for my purposes, and then I'll explain about how my priorities are met by this thing called a log structure file system, and with a particular focus on volume management, thank you, on NFS, on RAID, because that's where my focus is, and things like that. Yeah, well, different file systems, different needs. Different people have different needs. I was just going to go through some of the file systems that we currently have in Linux and look at, well, what sort of needs do they meet? The first one, EXT3, it's one I use mostly on my file servers and my desktops. Why do I choose that? Well, because it's compatible with EXT2. There's a lot of history in EXT2 in Linux. It's fairly stable. It's well understood. People know how it works. And there's this great tool called E2FSCK that, you know, fixes it up for you. As long as you haven't mangled it totally, you know, it can put that together. You can get at least a consistent file system that you can keep working on without any fear of further corruption. And that's a really valuable asset because, you know, disk drives have problems. Kernels sometimes corrupt data on your disk. And it's good to have that fallback. And so when you want reliability, you want a bit of history, you're a bit conservative, EXT3, I think, is a choice there over EXT2 if you want the protection that journaling gives you. Riserifus comes from a very different perspective. It's brand new. It doesn't have any real history behind it. But Hans Reiser talks a lot about semantic innovation. He wants things to be done differently. He has all these great ideas, and some of them, I'm sure, are really good. It was originally called Treefus, but that was too generic, and for some legal reasons, it was changed to Riserifus. It's all one big tree. There isn't a separate inode table. Don't know how well people know how standard Unixy file systems work. They tend to have a separate inode table. Riserifus doesn't. The inodes are sort of tagged on the file names in the directories with special handling for hard links and stuff. And so it's all one big tree. It's apparently quite efficient for small files. It's sort of one of his main sponsors was someone doing a web server with lots of little files that need to be served up, so they had to have good performance of big directories of small files, and indeed it does. So, you know, if that's what you're looking for, you don't need to be certain you've got a FSCK. I mean, there is a Riserifus FSCK, but it's nowhere near the quality of E2. I've never used I've made a few Riserifus file systems just for making sure I can export the NFS and stuff, but I've never really used it. So there's a couple of options. Others, XFS from SGI. One of SGI's big selling points was multimedia stuff. They wanted to be able to get data off the disk into the application as fast as possible, streams of audio data and video data and stuff. That's where one of the big markets is into audiovisual stuff. So very big files, very fast data. Try and get the files out of the way and just move the data. So that's their focus. And if you want to do that, I'm more certain XFS is the way to go. JFS, I know almost nothing about. It's from IBM. It's called JFS. It uses B-trees and stuff. I was thinking if you're going to write a new file system today, it wouldn't look like EXT3. EXT3's got a lot of history. It probably would look like JFS. You know, you'd use B-trees for indexing stuff, and you'd use extents, and lots of sort of good ideas and modern file system technology would be there. So it's all-round form, good all-round performer, I expect. It's also, you know, a compatibility thing. If you've got file systems in JFS on your, I don't know, who else, OS2 system or AOX system or something, you can move them across to Linux. And there's lots of other file systems, FAT, Krampus, Jade, FFS for flash cards, and a lot of them for compatibility and for special purposes like compressed file systems and CD-ROM file systems. So lots of different choices, all with different particular focuses. And then there's LAS, which is the file system I'm working on. And my focus is a departmental file server. Just a file server, basically serving NFS, because that's what we use, serving hundreds to thousands of clients. This is sort of a project I've been working on, making Linux actually work in this context. Since mid-99, I've been sort of making the NFS server bit work and software RAID working, and I want a file system that ties it all together really nicely. As I said, I use EXT3, it works pretty well. It's occasionally corrupted my data, but not too much. What makes a departmental file server? Well, a few hundred gigabytes is about my target. I want it to work in that area. If it works fine on notebooks and on great big multi-terabyte systems, that's good too, but that's not a big concern of mine. So around that sort of size, based on commodity hardware, I don't want to have to buy anything special. I mean, I'm willing to maybe to buy some NVRAM if it makes a big difference, but I really like it to work really nice without that. Just, disks, SCSI cards, SCSI cables, no special RAID hardware preferably, because I'm not a big fan of hardware RAID. Good general purpose performance. I mean, I'd like to work on big files and small files, but there's no particular focus, there's no particular style of file it wants to work on, and if it's a bit slower on one sort, it's not a big problem. Good failure modes is really important. Obviously, if it crashes, you want it to come back up okay. But more than that, if people lose files, you want to be able to get them back fairly easily. You want to be able to cope with failure because, when you've got thousands of clients and they're working on their assignments or their research papers and they didn't make backups of their own because they never do and they just lost it and then they want it back straight away. So that's kind of important. Easy management. I'm a sysadmin when I don't get a chance to do programming and I want things to work really nicely. I want to be able to configure things so that users don't see any problems. And what does that mean? How do I build one of those things that fits all those requirements? Using a log structured file system, I'll spend a little while, if you're not too long, talking about what is a log structured file system, and then how I can use a log structured file system, those concepts, to meet a lot of my needs that I have. Going to incorporate volume management into the file system rather than have it separate, because that gives a lot of benefit to the file system in terms of manageability. Optimize it for RAID and NFS, and we'll talk about how if the file system knows about the RAID device underneath it, it can do some things that makes performance a lot better. Implement efficient backups. I really hate it when I start I do a full backup of my systems every week or so, a whole thing onto tape, and I really hate it when that's still running in the morning, which has happened on one of my slower machines. Largely, I think part of that was due to slow hardware. It's 5-year-old hardware now. Part of it's due to a lot of fragmentation that happened in the XT3 file system over sort of a period of a few years that it was just seeking all over the place. Make quotas work well. This is kind of a bit of a bugbear of mine, as you'll see in one of the later slides. We currently have two sorts of quotas, user quotas and group quotas, and I don't like either of them. And as an admin, that can be a problem. I used to get mail about quotas. I'm quite right, they don't do what I want. So I want to get rid of that mail so I can spend the time on programming instead of answering mail. So what's log structuring when it comes to file systems? It's not a new idea. It's an idea from about 10 years ago. Rosenblum did a thesis, his PhD thesis, about log structuring for file systems. The goal was to get faster write throughput. As I understand it, you can always improve the read throughput, by putting more caches in front and doing more read ahead and stuff. Write throughput is kind of hard to improve in a general file system because it's got to seek all over the place to update the metadata and the data and stuff like that. So the goal was to be able to write really quickly to the disk. Because disks, are always slower than computers by orders of magnitude. It was implemented in some research operating system called Sprite OS. So you had I haven't heard much of it in the last few years, so I don't think anything's happening with it. But so it was real implemented. The BS, some people at Berkeley thought it sounded like a cute idea, and they picked it up and implemented LFS in Berkeley and BSD, and I think you can still find traces of LFS in NetBSD. I couldn't find it in FreeBSD anymore. It doesn't seem to be maintained at all. I think I heard a rumour that somebody was going to maintain it, another rumour that somebody's going to pull it out. So it's kind of languished. And part of this reason was because the people who did BSD, LFS in BSD, did some tests, you know, compared with FFS, the Berkeley Fast File System, and said, well, it's not really convincing. You know, the theory is it should make writes a lot faster. Does it? Well, in some circumstances, maybe. In other circumstances, other common circumstances, not really. And it wasn't convincing. And so there was no strong need to change everything from FFS to LFS, so they didn't, and it just languished. But that doesn't bother me, because my focus isn't particularly on getting good speed. I think there are lots of other interesting things about log structuring that that can give you a really interesting file system. So what is log structuring? I'm going to sort of compare it a bit to FFS. If you've ever done an OS course and learnt about how file systems work on the inside, you probably looked at either a FAT file system or an FFS-style file system. If not, well, hopefully it won't lose you. The LFS has got, I guess, two main ideas that differentiate it from FFS, which I'll call a more flexible layout, more flexible way of positioning things on the disk, and a very different free space management, which is as a reusable log, and it's from that we get the word log structured. A tree-based layout, what do I mean by that? Well, there's no fixed location for anything except the root of the tree. There's a tree, don't try and it has a root that tells you where the next layer of stuff is, and then it tells you where the rest is. So all you need to know is where the root is, and you can find anything else. Everything else can be anywhere on disk you like. So there's one fixed location for the root, and everything else is wherever. This contrasts with FFS, which has a fixed inode table. The original Unix Edition 7 file system had the inode table at the beginning of the disk. It was that big, and there it was at the beginning. FFS, one of the reasons it's faster is the inode table sort of chopped up and distributed over the disk drive, so it's the seeks to get there are often a lot shorter. But still, it's a fixed size, it's a fixed location, that's where it has to be. But a log-structured file system, instead of storing the inodes in a fixed table on disk, it stores them in a file. So you have a file with an inode with indirect pointers to the blocks of the file, and in those blocks of the file you have all your inodes. And so hence, most, except for this root inode, all the inodes can be anywhere on disk you like. So which means you can add more inodes. You don't have to decide when you make your file system how many inodes you want. I don't know if you run MCFS, I can't remember if it prompts, it used to prompt you, what percentage of your blocks you want to use in inodes. It just becomes a irrelevant concept if you stick them in a file. Rather than a fixed table. The other thing is that FFS and EXT2 and 3 have in a fixed location is indicate information about the free blocks. They have a bitmap that covers every block in the file system, one for free, zero for used, or reverse, I'm not sure. And that also is in a fixed location. It's usually stored in inode table, free block map, then a little bit later, more inode table, more free block map. So that's another thing that's in a fixed location. And LFS has something equivalent to a free block map. It's a bit different because free space is handled differently. But it's also stored in a file. So once you put those two things in a file, the only thing that has a fixed location on disk is the root of your tree. So now the inode of the inode file can be easily found. That's the first thing you have to find. You have to find the inode that describes where all the other inodes are. Once you've got that, you can find the inodes, you can find the data blocks and the indirect blocks, you can find the directories, you can find everything. We actually store several copies of the super block with the version number. This is, which we'll get to a bit later, important aspect of the log structured file system is you only ever write over data that you're not interested in anymore. You only ever write over a bit of disk where, as far as you're concerned, that data's dead. It doesn't matter if it gets corrupted. So if you just had one super block location, we wrote the super block on top of that, then if you got corrupted during the write, you've kind of lost everything. So you have two, or maybe some large number of copies of the super block.
So it's a phase-free file
system? It has similarities to a phase-free file system. Possibly it is. Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what the definition of it is, but... So I think it just falls off the bottom of the screen. If you just make that change to put the inode table and stuff into files, then you essentially have what Dan Phillips did with Tux2. So a line off the bottom says, Daniel Phillips did with with TAX2. TAX2 was a modification of the XT2 that used a phase tree file system that put everything into, put inodes and stuff into trees, and then you have a similar sort of concept. TAX2, I tried to convince Daniel Phillips of this, but he wouldn't listen or wasn't interested at the time or something, but TAX2 just wouldn't work real well with NFS. There are issues there that just, it would be terrible. But yes, it's like a phase tree sort of idea. So you have several copies of Superblock, and each time you write a Superblock, you bump the version number. So you write version 0 there, and then version 1 there, then 2 there, and then 3 there, and then 4 there, and so forth. So you're never overwriting data that's of any interest. So it allows any part of the file system to be stored anywhere on disk, which is useful. We'll find out why soon. How's free space managed? Well, it's like a log. A transaction. If you think about a transaction log, you just have sort of data, and you, whenever you make a change, you write a transaction that describes that change, you know, change this block to a new location and new value, and change this block in a directory to a new value, and so forth. So just writing out changes. So you've got a bit of disk that currently has nothing of any interest in it, and you write out changes to it. Right? Now, if you just obviously just did that, you'd run out of disk, and where would you be then? Nowhere. So what we divide the device up into segments. Segments are a few megabytes each. You can work out the optimal size soon. Each segment is either in use or it's free, and the free ones you write out to, and the in-use ones you obviously don't write to at all yet. We have a current segment we're writing to. We write linearly all the data, any changes into that. We might write data, then we might write an indirect block that refers to that data, and then we might write a new copy of an inode that refers to that indirect block, and eventually, you know, we might do this for quite a while, and then eventually we'll write a new copy of the root inode and update the superblock to point to this new location. So things just get written out consecutively. Whenever you're writing to consecutive locations on disk. You're not sort of seeking all over the place to update data here and metadata there and so forth. Exactly, yeah. When you, if you've got a file, you overwrite a file, and typically you don't overwrite a file. Well, some editors do, some editors don't. They unlink it and write a new one. But in any case, it would write it to a new place, and the old bit of data would become dead. It would become largely inaccessible. And we need to find out what we do with that dead data in a minute. A cluster at a time. We'll see what a cluster has actually a header that describes the cluster and then the actual data. So you have a sequence of clusters. Sometimes a cluster will be the full size of a segment, sometimes it'll be smaller, just depending on how much that pressure there is to write data at the moment. So when the current segment's full, you find a free one and keep going. And if the time to write, so you're writing consecutively, if the time it takes to write to a segment is much more than the time it takes to seek to a new segment, right, then you're spending most of your time writing, and that's where the idea of a good write throughput comes from. So suppose seek time's what, about 3 milliseconds, something like that. Suppose you've got a 30 megabytes a second write speed, something like that. Then you want to spend, so it's 3 millisecond seek time, you want to spend, say, 30 milliseconds writing at 30 megabytes a second. It's I can't remember, a few megabytes, 3 megabytes, something like 3.3 megabytes or something like that. So if you make your segments about that big, then when you've got lots of data to write, you write sort of like for 30 milliseconds there, and then seek and write for 30 milliseconds somewhere else, and you can be spending 90% of your time writing, which means you get good throughput. That's the theory anyway. But what happens when you run out of segments? Obviously, you're writing to a clean segment, so there's fewer and fewer clean segments. What do you have to clean? You have to clean up after you. As files are deleted, as files are overwritten, as we mentioned, blocks in earlier segments become unreachable, unaccessible, they're dead, basically. We need to do something about that. Possibly all the blocks in some segment might become all of them dead. You can't reach any of them. Well, that means that segment's effectively clean now. You can go back and write to that, and that's really good. More often, you'd find that a lot of the blocks are dead, maybe half of them, maybe three quarters of them. A few of them are still alive, and you've got to do something about that. You can't write to that segment until you've cleaned it. So what you need to do is you find all the blocks in that segment that are live and relocate them to a new segment. So you might find 10 segments that are like 10% full, relocate all the blocks into one segment, and you've suddenly gained 9 clean segments out of that. So we need to identify the live blocks. We need to relocate them to a new segment. So we have a thing called a cleaner, yes? Well, it is something that has to be running all the time. Ideally, you would, A, have your file system with like 30% free space all the time or something. The price of disks these days, I think that's quite a reasonable goal. And presumably your load isn't constantly, I mean, if your load is constantly really high, then you're not going to have any windows for doing this cleaning, and it's you're going to have to just clean and slow down your write throughput. You know, that's life. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so you sort of, you try and schedule your cleaning at idle times. You monitor the throughput of the disk drive. When it drops down, you pick up the cleaning a bit.
There is another solution to that. They used to make hard drives that had separate read and write heads. And then you can do that in line because you can actually keep writing the new data that you're cleaning up and you pick up
on the read. Yeah, of course, you're not always writing to disk. Sometimes you're reading from disk as well. So. Right. A typical load, you're doing lots of reading and lots of writing.
For this kind of file system, that architecture of read and write is actually a big advantage, but sadly they don't make that very much anymore now.
No, yeah. But again, it's not commodity hardware, and you know, I really, really want commodity hardware.
Do you use a space processor to do this?
No, this is in the kernel. It may well be user space tuning. User space may well monitor the system and give a more sophisticated sort of guidelines to the kernel about, you know, these segments, I want you to do these segments now, and it might also, user space might sort of look for files that are highly fragmented and encourage the kernel to clean those segments altogether so that you reassemble files. But yes, it's in kernel, it's happening all the time in kernel, user space might tweak it a bit. So how can we clean? How can we identify which blocks are live? How can we relocate them? Well, we need, as I said, each cluster has a descriptor at the front, which says, well, you know, the first block in this cluster is block 27 of inode 3, and the next block is block 28 of inode 3, and the next block is block 400 of inode 7 or whatever. And so it's a block that, a 1K block or one block of descriptor, and then, you know, maybe hundreds of K of actual data. And so when you go and look at a cluster, you can look at each of those blocks and say, well, this is, when it was written, it was block X of file Y. Let's find block X of file Y now and see if it's at the same place. If it's at the same place, we have to relocate it. Is it a different place? We don't. It's obviously already been relocated. You need to, the cleaner would need to be reading these cluster headers and doing the cleaning based on that. We have a cluster usage table, which is fairly central to the way it all works, which is again stored in a file. This is sort of the equivalent of the free space map. For each cluster, it records how many blocks are in use in that cluster, how many blocks in that cluster are live. And whenever you delete a file, you have to update the cluster table to say, well, there's a few fewer blocks in that cluster that are live now. Also, some information of how old that segment is, how long ago it was written. And then you go and and when you want to clean up, when you do want to do some cleaning, you find a segment that is not very full. It's got mostly dead blocks, find one of the fewest dead blocks, but also take into account that segments that have been written recently, the file that's been written recently are more likely to be thrown away soon, right? So if a segment's been written recently and is a lot of the data is already dead, don't clean it just yet, because in another 5 minutes, even more data will be dead and it'll make your job easier. So you keep track of the age and you keep track of how full each segment is. And based on a simple heuristic, you thereby choose which segments to clean, and you clean those segments. And hopefully you only clean fairly small amounts of data most of the time to get there. So we use these to guide selection of which cluster to clean and then location of those live blocks and relocating them into a new cluster. So what does log structuring give us? it gives this data being written in large chunks, contiguous chunks, places where we choose on disk. You know, we're not forced to write to some particular location. We sort of have some control about where we write things. Gives us data always written to unused portions of a device. I remember Ted Show talking about issues with the XT2, and there are some drives when the power goes, you know, it's writing out the super block, writing out 90 table, and garbage ends up there. If you're overwriting data that is important to you, there's some chance you'll lose it, particularly on cheaper hardware. Right? If you're overwriting data that's not important to you, then you don't lose nearly as much. The data you get, as long as you can check whether the data you've written is valid or not, which you can do, you're much less chance of losing anything.
How does this work when you've got files which aren't necessarily being created, deleted, but you've got something like a log file which gets appended to, and it might get appended to, you know, a couple of lines every 10 minutes or something over a long period of time? Does that not mean that kind of file would get basically all over the disk?
Well, it would tend to get all over the disk, yeah. Is that a problem? Possibly the cleanup daemon. I mean, if you find that's a problem, if there are files that you're writing slowly, but you want to be able to read quickly sequentially, then you could get the cleaner to do some sort of defragmentation of files as it finds them. But yes, there are some. Some access patterns that would be really bad. I mean, particularly if you think about if you made a file in this file system, you swap file and swap to it, there'd be random writes all over the place. It'd be terribly fragmented. You wouldn't do that. But yeah, for a lot of common access methods, it can work quite well. And again, hopefully, if it's you're writing to it, hopefully a lot of it's still in cache if when you go to read from it. And files in XT2 get fragmented too. That is one of the speed issues. When they looked at speed of it, it does tend to cause more file fragmentation, but their implementation didn't have any attempt to try and defragment files. But yeah, writing to unused portions of the device is actually really, really valuable. Recently written data can easily be found. When you're writing clusters, each cluster's got a header, the cluster headers are actually linked together to each other. And you can find them. So when you write the cluster header and you write the cluster, and it's safe. You don't have to go back and update any metadata of the superblock, because the superblock will point sort of to where you last wrote, and then you can follow a chain of clusters through that. And so that means when you crash, you just come up and you follow through the chain of clusters and figure out where you're up to. So you've got sort of built-in crash recovery. Old data is not overwritten immediately, right? So you write out a file, and you write out again, it goes somewhere else, the old data isn't immediately overwritten. And that gives the opportunity of doing snapshots of sort of saying, well, take a copy of the root of the file system now and record it somewhere, and then keep writing to new clusters. And if mount that somewhere as 1 o'clock today, and then mount it again at 2 o'clock today, and mount it again at 3 o'clock today. You've got sort of online backups every hour fairly recently. Obviously, the cleaner needs to know about that, and the cleaner doesn't want to destroy any blocks that are currently in one of those active snapshots. But that's all quite doable. That's sort of, if you ever used a NetApp, they have a .snapshot directory that does the same sort of thing. It's a very, very similar sort of concept. Obviously, you need to have enough disk space to store the original and all the deltas, but you know, if it's a valuable thing to you, you pay for the disk space.
I thought that was actually where Jamie was running into a bit of strife with NetApp or some other corporation type who had done this kind of thing. He said, no, so you can't do it because it's our proprietary technology.
Well, yeah, Daniel Phillips has said things about patents. Yeah, I have two attitudes. One is I kind of agree with what Linus said once, which was that technologists should worry about technology and lawyers should worry about patents. And he also said that this isn't legal advice and you shouldn't pay any attention to it, but I kind of like it. Also, I mean, there's lots of things. I've read some of NetApp's papers, and while there are obviously similarities, there are also lots of, you know, very substantial differences. And I have no idea if a patent would hold or if it would mean anything. I'm not going to let it worry me. So you can have snapshots, which is good for backups and good for users. You know, we occasionally get mail. I just deleted a file. Can I get it back? Did you have it there last night when the backups run? No? Oh, well, no. But it'd be nice to be able to say yes. Okay, how am I going for time? I've taken far too long on that bit. Yeah. Okay. So hopefully now you've got a picture of what a log structured file system looks like, and I want to fit some things into that and show you how we can do some slightly interesting things. First doesn't really require a log structured file system, but it helps a bit, and that is volume management. Volume management is where you have your file system, you have sort of a number of different disks and you kind of join them together into one big disk. Or maybe you join them in together into a number of virtual disks. So you can sort of, and you can make disks grow and disks shrink and stuff. And I must say, using an LVM layer in between. And I'm no big fan of LVM. It seems to me the wrong approach. It's obviously a necessary approach in a lot of cases because your file system expects a single device and what you've got is multiple devices. You've got to do something. But I'd much rather the file system understood about having multiple devices. If you think about LVM, you know, LVM chops a number of devices up into what are they called, physical elements or something, then joins them together again into virtual devices, and then the file system chops that up into the blocks and joins them up into files. That's this sort of double handling, which is really ugly, I think. It's simple, it's flexible, you can do stuff with it, but it does have this double handling, and it hides the real device characteristics from the file system. And I remember the days when you told your file system about numbers of cylinders and sectors and heads because it used that information. And it can't do that anymore because drives tend to lie about their geometry for various reasons. These days, RAID systems and the performance of the get-out-of-a-RAID system, you know, can depend a lot on whether you access it in the right order or not. So I really like my file systems to know about the RAID geometry underneath it. If you use LVM, that's all lost. So, the better approach is to use a file system. Just tell the file system, you know, here are some devices, put your data there. And it allows devices to be added. You know, if it knows about two devices, then knowing about three devices is not much harder. It means you can add another device and grow your file system without having to make it pretend that your device just got bigger. We really added another disk to some sort of array thing. It's not a new idea at all. If you ever use digital or compact or HP or whatever they call it today, advanced file system, it can do all this stuff. And I've used that to good effect once or twice. But it's not a common idea, but I think it's a powerful idea, so it'll be incorporated. But how does this relate with log structuring? Well, because in log structured file system, you've got this cleaner that's always looking for segments to clean and to relocate the data on. Suppose you've got this multi-device file system, you want to actually take a file device out because it's failing maybe, or because it's too small and you really want to put a big one in there or something. Or you might have got faster disks or something, and it's a different size, and you can't just sort of mirror it across and pull it out. It's a different size.
Does this mean you can use it on a word meter as
an actual high-rate? You could theoretically use it on worm meter, yeah. I haven't really looked into that very much. You'd really need to be cleaning everything off onto a new device or something. But, yeah, so you can move, if you want to free up a device, you just tell a cleaner. User space says to the cleaner, hey, these segments, even though they're really full, clean them. And it does, and then the device is empty and just pull it out and put new devices in. So there's the management sort of issue. You can just do that sort of stuff. And also different priority devices. This is, you can, when it writes out new data from the file system requests, it writes it often to a different place than when it's cleaning. It cleans data because new data is probably very volatile and data that's being cleaned is probably not very volatile. So what it does is in the background, it cleans a bunch of segments into this new segment, then atomically adds that segment into the file system, whereas new data gets written into a different segment. Now, because of those differences, you might in fact want new data to be written to this really fast, possibly quite small device, either an NVRAM card or maybe a little RAID 1 array that's, you know, fast, lots of linear writes to it. But all the, when data is cleaned, once it's been in the file system for a while, it's probably stable, you copy it off onto your RAID 5 false device, which is probably slower, but also probably much bigger. And this is kind of with my EXT3 systems at the moment have got an external journal. The external journal is either on a RAID 1 or an NVRAM card, and that gives much, much better performance than having the journal on the same device as everything else. Because that journal, which is similar to the log in the log structured file system, gets lots of I.O. to it, whereas a RAID 5 doesn't get quite as much. And the journal, particularly the NFS, the journal needs to respond quickly, whereas the RAID 5, the background cleaning doesn't need to be as quick. So, and you can just have that. You have multiple devices and some are different priority and it's sort of kind of more natural. And EXT3, the external journal is kind of a wart on the side in a way. It's not very natural. It's stuck on the side and it's actually accessed by device number rather than name, which is kind of awkward when you have SCSI devices that change numbers. But so it's not perfectly, and it's not tested as much. It's not tested as much as the rest of the code because it's an extra feature on the side. And also, as I said, you can see the RAID geometry of devices. And why do we need to see the RAID geometry of devices? Because a RAID pretends to look like one big disk, but obviously it isn't. There are lots of speed issues for various reasons. The first one is to do with head contention. Like when you have multiple threads all accessing a RAID array, like a RAID 0 or something, or a RAID 5 at the same time, you'd really prefer separate heads to be actually hitting different drives as much as possible. Obviously it won't all the time, but that when you have two separate threads hitting the same drive, that's called head contention, because they're probably after different places on the drive, right? So if every file is like one block here, one block here, one block here, one block there, block, 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 then any read of any sort of reasonable size is going to hit all the drives, so you get lots of head contention. If you have a larger chunk size and a number of files typically mostly on one drive, then you get better performance. And you can, when you're building a RAID 0 or a RAID 5, you can set the chunk size to try and get the best sort of performance, but it's kind of only heuristic. The file system doesn't know where the chunks are and can't line up files with the chunks at all. If the file system knows about your RAID 0 device, and if you tell it, you know, what the geometry is, then it can actually try and be intelligent and try and say, well, all these blocks are in the one file, let's sort of, where possible, stick them on the one device, right? When you're writing, so when you're reading, you'll get them all back on the one device. There won't be any contention. So it's good to be able to know these things. But more significantly is the RAID 4 or 5 sort of case where you have to update parity. If you know, I don't know if you know how RAID 4 and 5 work, but basically you've got four drives, then three at any particular address on the drive, three of them contain data, and one of them contains a parity block. And if any of those blocks gets lost because the drive goes out, you can figure out what it was from the missing one. So if you just update one block on a RAID 5 array, you have to somehow update the parity block as well, and that typically means read the old block, read the old parity block, do the computations and write them back out again, right, which is slow. Writing a single block to a RAID 5 device is kind of slow. Writing lots of blocks, you can sometimes, if you're lucky, you get requests to write that block, that block, that block, and that block before you have to actually commit any of them to disk, and then you don't have to pre-read anything. You just work out the parity from all the new data and write it back. That's best. When you're doing large sequential writes, you get a lot of that. When you're doing random writes to lots of different files, you don't get a lot of that, right? But with a log structured file system, remember you're always writing, no matter which files they are, whose files they are, they're always writing sequentially to a large chunk. Remember, you write a bunch of clusters into a segment. If you pad each cluster, if you ever write a small cluster, you pad it to fit exactly a number of stripes. Then every write is going to be stripe wide. It's going to write all the data blocks in a stripe. And that means you never, ever, ever need to pre-read data, pre-read parity. You can just always write straight onto a RAID 5. So it's just a little bit of tuning and sort of letting the file system know about the RAID underneath. You can get much better write performance. And I haven't actually had a chance to test this yet, but I suspect that's going to get much better performance out of a RAID 5 array. Also, as I said before, you're always only ever writing over dead data, and that's a good thing for RAID 2, because if you write to a RAID 5 array and your machine crashes, somebody pulled the power out. When it comes back up, one of the disks is missing. Maybe it was dead already. Maybe the power fluctuations killed it, right? Then it's possible that some other block on data somewhere has been corrupted. Because when you write a block, you've got to write the data and the parity. And if you wrote one of those but not the other, and you lose a disk block, you lose one of the disks, then the block on that disk, you can't really be sure what it was, because the parity may not be up to date anymore. So it's possible, if you're overwriting live data on RAID 5, it is vaguely possible to lose data. I'd rather not do that. Log structured file system doesn't require you to do that. You can go back and have a look at the data you wrote out and see if it's consistent or not. Possibly you can store a checksum in the segment header, or there are other ways of being sure after the fact whether the data was successfully written or not. So it works much better with RAID 5. In fact, I prefer to use RAID 4. My ideal RAID configuration with log structured file system is a RAID 4 array. So RAID 4 has got one parity block and then lots of data blocks. The reason people use RAID 5 is because random single block updates will always hit the parity disk, right? And you want to spread the parity around so there's no one hot disk. But if every write is always write ride, then every write will always hit the parity disk and every data disk and will be more efficient. And so distributing the parity doesn't make any sense. So RAID 4 works fine. And if you've got RAID 4, then the organization of the data on the disk is nice and rectangular geometry. The file system can understand that, can lay things out properly. You can actually also, if you do the layout the right way, you can add extra drives. People are always asking on the RAID mailing list, how do I make my RAID 5 array bigger? How can I add a drive? And there is this program someone wrote that sometimes works and sometimes doesn't. but with this sort of setup, just add another drive, zero it, and bang, it's in. There's no complexity. Well, you do it all at once, yeah. This is what the RAID code in Linux does at the moment. When you write a full stripe, it's got all the data in buffers, it calculates the parity, and it schedules all those requests at once, and they all happen eventually. How am I going for time? 4 minutes, not enough. NFS, so that's how it works really well with to support RAID. NFS, obviously NFS isn't the only protocol for serving files, but it's one we use, so it's one I want to support. A particular issue for NFS is responding to writes really quickly, because for NFS, the server can't respond to a write request or a create request or a delete request until that data is actually safe on disk, right? So you've got, a multi-millisecond, 10 milliseconds, 20 milliseconds, that can delay sometimes between requests, and that can really hurt performance. That's why Big Iron put NVRAM in there so that the request can be stored safely in NVRAM and replied to quickly. And then later on figure out about writing it to disk. But again, with log structured file system, you don't have to make the data safe, you don't have to write the data, seek somewhere and write the metadata, seek somewhere and write the inode, or whatever. You just have to write everything you need to write all in one big blat, so it's sort of one seek, one write. Maybe two writes, actually, because you do one seek, one write. When they've all committed, you sort of write another block at the end as a marker to say it's committed, and it's done. So you can get low latency writes, which is really important for NFS. As I said, and the idea of there is still room to have an NVRAM device in there, sort of as naturally as part of the file system. I've got a couple of NVRAM cards. In some cases, I can easily measure 10 or 20% speed up on some NFS benchmarks. So I'm not 100% certain whether it's really worth the money to be fast in a little RAID 1 array, not yet, but it's certainly a possibility. Supporting backups. As a sysadmin, I have to do lots of backups because my users demand it, even though they almost never restore data. Actually, we have some backups that are sort of individual file, incremental backups that are online and people can restore from them. People actually restore from them a surprisingly large amount. People sometimes restore files at 6 months old and at 9 months old, which is amazing. But we need to be able to back up the entire file system. We need to sort of do a complete dump of the file system to some sort of media, like tape, in case something horrendous goes wrong. And something horrendous has gone wrong on about 3 times I can think of on our file servers for various reasons, bugs in Linux or dodgy hardware or things like that. You need to sort of have a fairly recent backup. And to create a backup, basically you've got to get all the data off the file system onto tape, or onto another disk, or onto something. You've got to get it off the machine. And we want to get this off as quickly as possible. So we need to write all the data to tape. We want to minimize the seats, you know, watching, doing a backup of the file system. You know, you read to the root directory. Typically, I mean, what we currently use is CPIO archive, so you're walking down the file tree and finding files, and you're seeking all over the place and making a real mess. So it goes really slowly. We want to minimize seeks. The obvious way to do that, this is what I used to do 14 years ago, is DD the device onto tape. At the time, devices were small and tapes were slow, and it was the only way to do it. And that's really good. Don't seek at all, just zzzz. Still, it took hours, but this was at VAX or something. But that means you're backing up lots of dead data blocks, which is kind of a waste, and it means it's kind of hard to restore. Sorry? No. Yeah, ElectVax, Elect70. We want to be able to only back up new data. I mean, currently, we limit the size of the file system so some of it fits on a LTO tape, you know, our current storage technology. Each file system has to fit on one of those or we have a problem. I'd like to be able to relax that and easily, you know, back up all the old data onto one tape and then all the new data onto a different tape, and then next week just back up all the new data again, which probably only 50% of the actual data on the file system is likely to change from week to week, or much less probably. So you just want to be able to back up new data. Also want to be able to run on a live file system. Most backup approaches, you run on a live file system and maybe you'll get consistent data and maybe you won't. Certainly things like dump and restore, they always recommend don't run it on a live file system, but who can shut their file system down for long after a backup these days? We certainly can't. We used to turn it off every Sunday. I'd come in and turn the computer as well. We take turns. Can't do that anymore. So what we do in a log structured file system is focus on the segments. Back up a whole segment at a time. There might be some dead data in that, but hopefully there'll be a lot of clean segments so you don't bother backing up. You back these segments up in reverse chronological order onto a tape. And finding the order isn't too hard. You've got that segment usage file that contains timestamps and stuff. And reverse chronological order means, because you always write out index information after the data, right, then you're always going to get index information first. So you could scan through, with a little bit of work, you could scan through all the segments in reverse chronological order looking for certain files, and you'd always find the index information before the actual data. So just a single pass should be able to get most of the data. If looking for individual files, if you want to restore the whole file system, which is probably the normal approach with these sort of backups, again, that's a bit interesting. You basically need to write all the segments back into a new file system and then run the cleaner, busily to count up lots of things. So restoring is kind of interesting. It's not trivial to restore when you've done a backup like that. But we do a backup sort of every file system every week. We restore, you know, maybe once a year. You've got to get, you know, the complexity at the right place. Basically, if you're doing backing up whole segments, because segments are rather large, you're still seeking to get to the segments, but you're, you know, spend 10% of your time seeking and 90% of your time actually transferring data, which is the sort of trade-off you want. And it's safe on a live file system, because remember, we're talking about snapshots and stuff. You'd never overwrite that data, so you sort of force a file system sync, so you've got a valid starting point, and then turn off the cleaner while you're doing your backup. New data will just keep going to all the clean segments, and you back up all the segments that at that point in time had data on it. And it should be substantially quicker than our current backups do it, are at least. Quotas. Just running a bit late. Second last slide, I think. This is just another aspect of file systems. Nothing at all to do with log structuring, but used to use user-based quotas. User-based quotas, the obvious idea, you charge each file based on who owns the file. Obvious, doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? Because sometimes it's the conceptual entity that owns the file is a group, and you know, different individuals write the files in the group directory and the quota gets charged to different people and it doesn't work. So you do group IDs based on quotas based on group ID, but that doesn't really work either, because someone says, I want to use my group IDs for access control. Novel thought, but he does, and doesn't want that to confuse quota management. So I currently actually have a patch for EXT2 and EXT3 that implements what I call tree quotas basically any subtree of the file system where the root of that subtree is not owned by root, but all the parents are, it defines a subtree, charged to the owner of the root of that little subtree. So each home directory basically is a quoted object. Doesn't matter who owns the files, it's charged to the right person. And all the problems suddenly went away when I did that. And so that's that sort of quoting. I could try and convince the ext2 developers to include my patches, but because inode space is kind of, I have to add a field to the inode, and they're unlikely to give way inode fields without a lot of argument. And the Jan Kara, who maintains the quota code, isn't convinced by my patch yet. So. I'm adding the tree ID. I'm adding essentially the owner of the root of the tree that it's in. Right. If you move a file into another tree, the tree ID changes. If you try and hard link a file into another tree, you get an error, cross device link. Which isn't maybe what you'd expect, but it's, if you think about it, it's what you probably really want. I mean, if quotas are turned on, right, who do I go to charge this to? I can't charge it to both of you, I'm just going to disallow it. If you try and move a directory, it doesn't work. But you don't often move directories. Root can move directories, but that causes a bit, there's a few interesting semantics, but it actually in practice works really well. So laughs will do that. Reliability, why do I think I'm going to be able to write a file system that actually works and that actually isn't going to corrupt everybody's data? And I mean, this is obviously a real issue for me. EXT3, which you know, I trust the developers a lot, has corrupted my data occasionally. And I think the first issue is documentation. I think there's a lot of evidence that if you document what you're doing first, you've got a much better chance of actually understanding it and actually writing good code. Tech is a perfect example. Donald Knuth, when he wrote Tech, he developed this documentation system, web, for documenting code as he wrote it. And Tech is amazingly stable. No, I don't expect to be that good, but documentation in advance, and I'm sort of well into documenting the data structures and the methodology and stuff. And it's much easier to change things when you're writing in English than when you're writing in C. And build a prototype and throw the prototype away. I've sort of got a prototype in user level space, and I'll throw that, but I'm running out of time. And testing. And where is it up? Yeah, documentation's been on the way. It's a prototype that does a few little things to test out the ideas. And it'll do more. And stay tuned if you're interested. I have to have something that can run in the kernel maybe in 6 to 8 months. I'm not sure. Thank you very much. I'm sorry I went 6 minutes over time. tildenlb/patches/treequota.
Okay, guys, thanks very much. This was very good, thank you very much. Please don't forget the speaker evaluation forms up the bot back, and if you don't have a pen now, you can take one and just give it to one of the organisers. We'll put it in a box later. Thank you.